Good evening, Los Angeles. Yeah. Welcome to the Talking Show on K Chung Radio, Chinatown's only micro broadcasting radio station. I'm Nicholas Miller, here with my tireless co-host, Steve Cato.
Hi, everyone. I'm Steve Cato, Nicholas's tireless co-host.
That's right. The Talking Show did just take a field trip to New York City, and we had a lovely time. We saw a lot of art, saw a lot of people, and we even went to that place called Vanessa's Dumplings, where unless you have cash, you have to spend at least $15. And the dumplings are something like five for a dollar. So Steve and I had to buy $15 worth of dumplings, which came out to be enough dumplings to feed a small army.
It was insane.
And Steve, because he's been on this intense exercise program, he just pummeled this pile of dumplings. I mean, they had no chance against Steve.
That's right. I mean, I actually have such a tweaked metabolism now that I just need an ungodly amount of carbs, you know? Ungodly.
Yeah, it was like that time where, Steve, you went up to Solvang for the Danish festival or Danish days or whatever
Danish
they call
days,
it. And you just destroyed all the Danish competition in that eating contest. What were you guys eating again? Some kind of Danish pastry or something?
These dumplings called Æbleskiver or some Æbleskiver. It's hard. It's Danish.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Steve has no problem in those situations.
No.
Well, we have a very interesting guest on the show tonight. We have Peter A. Diamond.
Sounds like a wrestler. You know?
No, Steve, he's not a professional wrestler. I mean, look at him. Does he look like a professional wrestler? Do professional wrestlers wear sloppy suits and ties like that? I don't think so. Actually, Peter Arthur Diamond is an American economist known for his analysis of U.S. Social Security policy and his work as an advisor to the Advisory Council on Social Security in the late 1980s. Yeah, those brutal 1980s. And the 1990s. He was awarded in 2010 the Nobel Memorial Prize in Economic Sciences. That's right. So not a wrestler, but a Nobel Prize winner.
What a badass.
On June 6th of 2011, he withdrew his nomination to serve on the Federal Reserve's Board of Governors, citing intractable Republican opposition for 14 months.
We know what that's
like. So yeah, Peter is here, and he has some brutal things to say about U.S. unemployment and U.S. economic policy. So please join us in welcoming American economist Peter A. Diamond.
And thanks to the committee for recognizing this long line of work, and thanks to the many other researchers who turned it into the kind of substantial body of work that the committee chose to recognize and that we helped launch and sustain. As Dale indicated, we've coordinated a bit on the sequence of presentations, but not thoroughly, so you'll hear some of the things for the second time, and perhaps in time for the third time. We've all visited several stores to check prices or to find the right item or the right size. In the same way, it takes time and effort usually for a worker to find a job and for employers to receive and evaluate applications for job openings. Search theory is an exploration of the workings of markets once facts such as these are incorporated into the analysis. To do the analysis, you have to consider not just the reactions to frictions, but how the reactions to frictions by others changes the economic environment. In other words, it's about search equilibrium, not individual search behavior. Search theory has altered the way we think about markets, how we interpret market data, and how we think about government policies. Today, I want to explore a few of the contributions of search theory, focusing primarily on early work, creating the line of research that could be done. And while my focus is on the labor market, I'm going to start with a retail market example. Then look, you've already seen it, but I'll have slightly different slides at the flows in and out of employment, and you'll see the beverage curve again, and a little bit about how I got to working on search, because as Dale said, I was off first in Nairobi and then in Jerusalem and then in Oxford, pursuing this and discovering when I got back what is not surprising in the research environment, which is when something is an interesting idea, it's in the air, and lots of people are thinking about the same sort of thing. So let me start with a retail market example. Economics education starts with the abstraction of an ideal market. There's demand, there's supply, there's a price that clears the market. And that's a very valuable starting place because even in flow markets, it shows some of the effects that are present in pretty much all markets. You get a boost in demand, it's going to drive up prices. That happens in lots of places. But in search markets, there are more things going on that you can't really address in that framework. And the role here is to recognize that a model is an incomplete picture of reality. In fact, that's the definition of a model. But without a model, you can't think logically, consistently, coherently about what's going on in the economy. So you build models to look at parts of the story and to see what lessons you can draw. In the simple market abstraction, each buyer knows how to purchase at the lowest price available in the market. And so each firm faces a discontinuity in sales when the price varies from the lowest price elsewhere. And that gives us the law of one price. All the sales happen at the same price, and that price is the marginal product of labor. In contrast, with a focus on the need to spend time and effort to learn about opportunities, whether buying or selling, hiring or being hired, that's going to change this story. The example that I was very aware of through this fall was my wife's search for ball gowns for the formal events this week. It was very time-consuming. Now, let's start with the simplest possible retail market. There's a standardized good. It's the same everywhere. And there are a large number of identical buyers and a large number of identical sellers. My 1971 paper that Dale referred to altered this by explicitly modeling how people find out about price. And the particular simplification I took is the only way you can find out about a price is to go to a market. So you go to a store, there's the object, you see the price, and your decision is, should I buy it, should I go to another store? And you don't know what the price is at the other store, but you have an understanding of the general distribution of prices that exist, and you recognize that if it's the same price in the other store, you might as well buy it here. And the firm recognizes that. The firm knows it has a little bit of market power, because once you're in the store, it's going to cost you something to go elsewhere. So the equilibrium happens through the interaction of all these little bits of market power. And the shocking result was that the equilibrium is the price a monopolist would charge if the monopolist controlled all of the outlets, rather than the competitive price, given that there are a large number of independent firms each setting prices. And the logic behind it is if all the stores are charging the same price, you could say I could charge a little bit more, but less than the cost of going to another store, and it won't affect my sales. So you're going to boost the price. And every firm is going to do the same thing. And that process only stops when you get to the monopoly price. So it's the interaction, the feedbacks of behavior of different people gives, in this case, the simplistic uniform price result and the shocking monopoly price result referred to in the literature naturally as a paradox. Because there's a discontinuity. Even a tiny search cost will do this, And when the search costs hit zero, suddenly you leap to the competitive price. That was not meant to be a realistic model of price determination. Rather, I set up a sequential model of customers visiting stores, and I said, where does it go? What's the equilibrium? What will happen? And then I was rather shocked to discover that it went to the monopoly price. And the impact on other researchers was by proving that search could make a large change in equilibrium, not just a small change. The nature of what to look for would change. Later work by many people bringing in heterogeneity, differences across buyers and sellers, different ways of learning about prices, gives really two results that are quite robust. You expect to find not the law of one price, but a distribution of prices in the market. And that is indeed what we normally find. And secondly, pretty much all of those prices are higher than marginal costs. They're not the efficient price element. So the purpose here, let me put this in the context of the research community, was not to capture some particular market as best I could, but rather to find a framework to indicate, is this something important to work on? Because research is very much a collective element. So let me turn now to labor market flows. At any time, as Dale said, there are both unemployed workers and posted vacancies. If you think about that in the static setting, you might think, as Dale indicated, that the wage isn't reaching the right level. A wage that doesn't clear the market, thinking in a dynamic setting, is referred to as a sticky wage. It's a wage that might change some, but not enough to clear the market. But also you might think this is just a terrible mismatch. The workers and jobs don't fit. The workers don't have the skills for the jobs, or they're in the wrong location. And so that's a second way you can have failure to markets to clear. So I want to show you some data on market flows. I can run through them a little bit quick because you've already seen a bunch. But there are monthly interviews of workers. And based on the interviews, workers are labeled as unemployed if they don't have a job and they're actively looking for a job, employed if they have a job, or out of the labor force if they don't have a job and have not done anything to actively look for a job. And a month later, you can ask people, where are you now compared to a month ago? And as Dale said, millions have changed position. Unemployed workers have found jobs. Lots of unemployed workers have left the labor force. Workers who are, quote, out of the labor force, not looking for a job, many of them have found jobs. And many of them are now searching for jobs, so they're unemployed. So the picture, and this is thanks again to Rob Scheimer, who, as Dale said, is sitting here today. Here's a picture of the rate of flow over the last 20 years. So in any month, 37% of the unemployed workers have moved into holding a job. So the process of people moving out of employment in the U.S., this is U.S. data, is just very rapid. The system converges quickly. But there's almost as large a flow of unemployed workers to what Rob labeled inactive, out of the labor force, too many letters to put on the bar graph. And as you can see, there are flows from workers who are out of the labor force into employment and into unemployment. Those flows are very large. The rate is small because there are so many people out of the labor force. And of the employees, as you see, there are large flows both into unemployment and directly into a position out of the labor force. Some of that is retirements. Some of that is I'm going to wait to search for a job for anyone of a variety of reasons. On average, over this 20-year period, roughly 6 million workers moved into employment each month, and roughly the same number moved out of employment in every month. So if you want to think about the stock of unemployed, you've got to think of it based on very large flows month by month, out of employment and into employment. And the rates in the figure are averages, and of course, there's great variation across groups, whether measured by characteristics such as education, race, or gender, or measured by the duration of unemployment spell, because the rate of coming out is much more rapid for those who are recently unemployed than those who are long-term unemployed. The U.S. is an outlier in these rates. This is just a focus on unemployment, saying people flowing in, people flowing out, not drawing the distinction between out of the labor force and employment. And you can see the U.S. way out there with very high inflow rates and very high outflow rates across different countries. And you can see a bunch of countries, including Sweden, that are in a middle category, and then there are countries that have labor markets that don't have much in the way of flows. The government policies around hiring and firing are viewed as playing a central role in determining whether an economy has large flows or small flows. And there's been major concern at the times of high European unemployment that it was the lack of the flows, the interference with hiring and firing, which caused that. If firms cannot easily or inexpensively get rid of workers, then they're going to be a lot more reluctant to hire them. We also have data coming from the employer side, and this data comes from Davis, Faberman, and Haltewanger, and Davis and Haltewanger and a series of co-authors have pioneered the exploration of this. So they looked at firms that had more employers than they had the quarter before. This is quarterly. And job creation was the percentage increase in employment at the firms that are increasing employment. And it's very large. So on average over the same 20-year period, each quarter there's a 7.5% growth in the employment in these firms. But there are also firms that are decreasing employment. That's happening simultaneously. And the rate of job loss in firms that are shrinking employment is almost as big as the rate of job creation. So again, the difference there, net amount, is very small. It's a difference between two big gross flows. Something that operates on a gross flow will have a big impact on a small difference between two flows. And if we look at hires, that's made up of job creation, but also hiring to replace a worker. That doesn't increase the employment level, so it's not part of job creation. And that's about twice as large as job creation. And if we look at separations, that's about twice as large as job destruction, because on average over this period, quits and layoffs are about the same size, but as Dale said, very different at different stages in the business cycle. So search theory was designed to make sense of these, how they fit together, how in particular government policies will determine the outcomes, and how we measure the relative efficiency of different ways of doing it. So let me talk briefly about unemployment benefits. I think each of us thought the other was going to talk a lot about unemployment benefits, and maybe Chris will, but I've cut it quite short. The primary purpose of unemployment benefits is to provide insurance to workers against involuntary job loss. And that will help them, and as Dale indicated, will also feed back in the output market by permitting them to go on making higher level of purchases than otherwise. Now, the provision of insurance of unemployment benefits affects the willingness of workers to accept particular jobs, making it more attractive to pass up a job that isn't a particularly good job and continue searching, looking for a better job. And it also affects the diligence with which some workers search for a job at all. This is always the case with insurance, with what economists call asymmetric information. The agency running the unemployment insurance program doesn't have a good handle on whether somebody's really searching properly for a job, really only passing up the jobs they ought to pass up. And so there's a lack of information on the part of the insurer, which then shows up in the ability of the worker, if the worker desires to search less hard, to pass up a job that perhaps the unemployment benefit provider wishes they would take. The fact that we have this kind of effect, what economists dub moral hazard, doesn't mean you shouldn't have insurance. It does mean that when you go to design the insurance, you've got to recognize two things are happening. One is you're providing the insurance, and the other is you're creating an incentive that changes behavior, and you've got to think of the importance of that. And the importance of that is going to be very different at different stages in the business cycle. So if we have a circumstance, let me just generally, if a worker is searching less hard, less willing to take a job, then it makes it harder for employers to fill a vacancy, but it makes it easier for other workers to find jobs. How important it is that somebody might be searching less hard depends on which of these two effects is more important. And the one that's more important depends on the state of the business cycle. At a time when there's high unemployment, firms are going to fill their vacancies very rapidly. And if some worker doesn't apply, but lots of other workers do, it really doesn't matter to the firm. And from the point of view of the workers, somebody else is getting a job, so they're happy. So at times like now, extending unemployment benefits, running them longer, while it does affect behavior, that effect is unimportant. A second element is these effects are what economists call externalities. It's effects on others that you don't have a direct relationship to deal with. And when that happens, the market in the absence of a government program is not necessarily efficient. So you can't say just because you've changed behavior, that's a bad thing. Now, the key shortcut in making this work is the matching function, which, just let me say, when you do theory, the matching function is really a meeting function, and then you have a theory of when a meeting leads to employment. And in empirical work, we don't have data on meetings, so matching means hiring. And from the context, I think it's very clear what's going on. In ordinary times, the literature said there's a value to having output, there's a cost to being unemployed, or a value to being off and doing whatever you happen to do, maybe positive, maybe negative. And we can think of those as driven by technology and opportunities at home, and we can analyze what's happening when the world is stationary. And in that setting, you can look at, say, unemployment insurance for ordinary times. What's critical is to deal with the more complicated items around the business cycle, around periods of sudden growth in employment and drops. Chris and Dale have advanced that analysis by examining dynamics around turning points when they change the value of that production or the cost of being unemployed. And it's the value of production that is the critical element. The key element is that those are endogenous variables. The extent to which it's worthwhile to produce is not something given by how productive a machine is. It depends also on your ability to sell it. And your ability to sell it depends on the employment that's happening elsewhere that's giving income to people to buy, or the profitability seen by a firm, which leads them to invest perhaps in inventory and in plant and equipment. And all of that matters. So this feedback pays attention. And in my 82 paper that Dale mentioned, I wanted to look at both markets at once, and I realized putting frictions in both of them was too complicated. I put the friction only in the output market, and then we get something resembling a business cycle in that you get inefficiency and you can have multiple equilibria, which means that there are items outside the model, and particularly expectations, that are going to drive things. If people coordinate on expectations, they could coordinate at different levels. And so different things can happen. Expectations become critical. On to the beverage curve. If you take the very simplest basic search model, set it up as a differential equation model, and the C in this refers to the business cycle, the relative rate of creation of new jobs, the destruction of jobs. And you start out at an equilibrium, and then you switch to the degree of profitability, you get a dynamic path. So that's the kind of math that's used to analyze these systems. And there, again, is the beverage curve. I've taken it from Rob Scheimer's webpage. And you can see two things there, the one that Dale emphasized, the general curve that you would expect, and the other, what has been happening over the last year. Because it's really the last year, unemployment has been pretty much stuck, measured vacancies has been rising, and the question is, what does that mean for what we ought to be doing about the economy? And here is an example of the kinds of statements that have appeared as a result. This is from the president of the Minneapolis Federal Reserve Bank. And what he says is, firms have jobs but can't find workers. Workers want to work but can't find jobs. And he goes on to say, it's hard to see how the Fed can do much to cure this problem. This is clearly a static picture of the world that makes no sense given the flows we've been talking about. Millions of workers are finding jobs each month. Millions of vacancies are being filled each month. The can't find doesn't make sense. What interested me is the same debate was going on when I started studying economics in 1960. And in 1964, here in Sweden, Bob Solow devoted the Wicksell lectures to rebutting claims that high unemployment was the new normal, what's to be expected. And the picture here for the hiring function shows the same thing, just to back it up. What I want to run through very briefly with you is why you shouldn't take these numbers literally. Because, first of all, as I've already said, a very large fraction of hiring happens with people who aren't unemployed. So measured unemployment is only a partial picture. And when we have extended unemployment benefits for the long-term unemployed as we have now, then people who would otherwise be out of the labor force are actively searching because that's a condition for getting the benefits, or at least they're reporting they're actively searching because that's a condition for getting. So the measure of unemployment is larger than it would otherwise be, because we don't have a flow out. And what we're interested in the actual economy is the sources of workers to fill jobs. The long-term unemployment has grown enormously over this last year. That's the last bar over 26 weeks, over half a year. What about on the vacancy side? Well, we've got the same kind of picture. You're measuring vacancies on a month-by-month basis. So a firm can post a vacancy and fill it, and in the data there's a hire, but there never was a vacancy. And you could not post a vacancy, but hire anyway. And John Heltoanger provided me an estimate that about 40% of hires show up without there being a measured vacancy. So the theory is about as you're measuring them for what results in hiring, unemployment as you're measuring people available to work, and the data is a proxy for that, but it's only a bad proxy, and at a time when we're having a severe recession of the like we have not seen for a long time, and certainly haven't seen anything vaguely resembling that in the time when we have the current data. Previously, we used a different source of data. So there are all sorts of reasons to think we shouldn't be overinterpreting the data. So again, from the Halterwanger analysis, speed of hiring is very different in different sectors. The construction sector posts very few vacancies when it does a lot of hiring. As you all know, construction is way down. So a sector where the relationship between hiring and vacancies would be very high isn't contributing. An establishment is growing fast, it fills vacancies more quickly than those growing slowly. I suspect, I haven't seen any data, we've got a different mix of fast and slow-growing establishments right now. Small firms are much more likely to hire without a measured vacancy than large firms. Giuseppe Mascarini has been studying the relative role of large and small firms over the business cycle, and he reports that the relationship between the hiring, or the job creation actually, of large firms versus small firms is unusual in this time, much higher for the large firms. And Bob Hall has suggested that the positions that a firm wants to fill after a quit are filled more quickly than newly created positions, because overwhelmingly, quits occur in high turnover jobs. High turnover jobs or low and generic skilled jobs, like fast food restaurants. So again, quits down is going to upset that relationship. Overdrawing inferences from this seems to me to be a major mistake, because historically, we find repeatedly claims, the new technology, automation, the internet, computers, this is going to, or the assembly line, back into the 19th century, this is going to give us permanent high unemployment, and then it doesn't happen. And it happens with business cycles. And the claim is that this is structural unemployment, this mismatch, and therefore it will be permanent. But that's a misreading of the way the economy works. When the labor market is tight, firms are more eager to hire. They will hire people that they wouldn't hire in times when the labor market is loose. And so what you might measure as structural is really being driven by the business cycle. And so that enhances the sense in which it's important to stimulate the economy, to limit the extent of continued growth of long-term unemployed, but mostly to not think this time is different from all the others and stimulating the economy won't work, because you can't be measuring structural unemployment independently of the state of the economy. It doesn't work. Thank you.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow, that was very enriching, eh, Steve?
Yeah, that was fantastic. You should be called Peter the Diamond.
Yeah. Well, I know you originally hail from Canada. How's the unemployment sitch up there?
Well, you know, it's been such a long time since I've lived in Canada that I'm not exactly sure what the unemployment situation there is. You know, it's hard to keep track of this stuff when you live in LA, right?
Yeah, that's about what I expected.
I mean, at the same time, I did move here because of the, you know, there are more opportunities in the field that I'm in, but, you know, the overall economy isn't really gauged on how easy it is for people with MFAs to get jobs in their field or, you know, do their work, right? We're not the, engine of the economy that, like, the manufacturing or resource sectors are, right? So, I mean, my own experience and that of my friends in Canada working in culture is quite grim financially, but the situation overall, I actually really just don't have an accurate picture to relay. I'm sorry.
Yeah. This makes our contracts here at Kaechung seem pretty cushy.
Amen.
I know I was complaining about them recently, but
yeah.
Those big severance packages come in handy
I know.
When you are unemployed. And I really hope to be here for a long time,
yeah,
but
awkward.
It is nice to know that we'll be riding, 5-year severance
yeah.
After our show here at K-Chung gets finally canceled.
Yeah, which, you know, knock wood again, doesn't seem like it's going to happen. You know, there's always a little bit of office politics at any broadcasting situation. So, you know, you hear things at the water cooler, at the, you know, not directly. Solomon hasn't had us in for a talk or anything. I think this is, in terms of ad revenue, one of the, you know, still pretty successful shows on K-Chung, even though it is at a weird time slot, and is maybe not the nonstop party that Yogi Proctor's show is, you know, or Ian James's. But anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know what I'd do with my severance pay. I think I'd probably just hang out at the beach, like, for years. Maybe buy a place in Topanga Canyon, fall off the face of the map. I can't grow a very good beard. Otherwise, I'd probably do that. But definitely some good beach time. How about you, Steve?
Yeah, I don't know. I was thinking about maybe finally building that sauna at my place, you know, on my land. Building myself a nice sauna and things like that. I don't know. That kind of thing. That's maybe what I'm more interested in, you know? Who knows? Yeah.
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 Yeah, I guess severance, like unemployment, doesn't motivate us to get another job. Isn't that right?
Yeah. I mean, unemployment is terrifying and severance is relaxing. Severance is like doing your job, but not having to do your stinking job.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, good thing we live in sunny LA where everyone is happy. But it's important to keep some perspective on the labor market out there.
It's bad.
So I hope everyone enjoyed our little talk by Peter A. Diamond. If you have any questions, feel free to go to our website and send us an email. We are in close contact with Peter, and he can answer any questions you have. So
we'll just forward them.
Please have a lovely evening, and we hope to see you next time on The Talking Show on K-Chung Radio. Good night, LA.
Good night.